From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, as testing for the coronavirus expands, the number of confirmed cases of the virus rises. Now, that should be no surprise. However, the increased numbers are being used by the media and others to fuel fear. Fear, which is then being used to drive policy changes that would never be considered or accepted under normal circumstances. Now, one of these areas that has the potential to do irreparable and far-reaching harm to America is the effort to change the rules of voting on the eve of the 2020 national elections. Now, President Trump has frequently expressed concern about efforts by Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic Party to move to all mail-in balloting. Now, the media, of course, has criticized the president, saying his fears are unfounded. But are they? Well, on today's program, we'll get to the facts on voter fraud in America. Does it really happen? Or is it a conservative straw man used to suppress voter turnout? Elections expert Hans von Spakovsky joins us with answers. And what accommodations can be made within the current election model that will not lead to chaos or confusion? What states have altered their election laws? Which ones are now more vulnerable to fraud? Jason Sneed, executive director of the Honest Elections Project, provides a rundown. And do we need to just resign ourselves to an election fraught with fraud and corruption? Thankfully, not. The law, at least for now, and in most cases, protects the integrity of our election system. It just needs to be enforced and upheld. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is doing that in the Lone Star State, and he's here to explain what he's done and why. And it's not just elected officials that need to protect the integrity of our election system. You and I have a part to play. In fact, a big part. What is it? Christian Adams, president and general counsel of Public Interest Legal Foundation, has the information that will equip us to help preserve our republic. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter or Parler, it is at T Perkins. Hey, by the way, speaking of voting, mark your calendars now, or better yet, register now, for the 2020 Values Voter Summit, September the 22nd through the 25th. Now, you might be thinking, oh, I can't make it to Washington for the summit this year. Well, here's the good news. You don't have to. This Values Voter Summit is going viral, a live, interactive, online gathering of values voters from across the country and literally around the world. Same great lineup of speakers, and you can participate right from your home. It's going to be interactive. It begins Tuesday, September the 22nd. We'll gather each night from 8 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. To register, go to valuesvotersummit.org or just go to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links over. Okay. While a lot more is known about the coronavirus today than when it began to spread after the first of the year, it has still altered life in America. As I said before, the virus is real. People have died from it, but most have not. I had it. I recovered just fine. Depending upon the way the numbers are crunched, the recovery rate is somewhere between 95 and 99%. But the sensationalizing that has surrounded the coverage of the coronavirus has fueled fears, changed behaviors, and empowered elected officials to put fundamental rights and freedoms at risk. Now, President Trump has been repeatedly pointing to the efforts that are underway to change voting rules as we approach the 2020 national election. Now, are his concerns valid? They've been dismissed by the press. But do we have reason to believe that changing the rules this late in the process could foster fraud and undermine the results of the 2020 election? Hans von Spakovsky is manager of the Heritage Foundation's Election Law Reform Initiative and a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. In 2017, President Trump appointed him to the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. He has served on the Federal Elections Commission and as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights in the Justice Department, providing expertise in enforcing Voting Rights Acts, the Voting Rights Act, and the Help America Vote Act of 2020. He is the co-author of the book, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. Hans, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let me just jump right into this. Is this something we should be concerned about? Is there fraud in our election system?
Yeah, there sure is, even though the left keeps trying to deny it. Back in 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Indiana's photo ID law. It was one of the first such laws passed in the country for in-person voting. And when they upheld it, they said the U.S. has a long history of voter fraud. It's been documented by historians and journalists, and it could particularly make the difference in a close election. And that, of course, is the key. We have close elections all the time in this country. I know folks right now concentrating on the presidential election, but we have very close elections at the local level, city and town council races, state legislative races, et cetera. And that's where we really ought to be worried about it.
And of course, Hans, you have documented many hundreds of cases of this at the Heritage Foundation, because you have a database of these and you show where election outcomes have been altered. And I want to get into that for just a moment. But before we go any further, I want to define what we're talking about. Now, the concern is not over normal or even expanded absentee voting that is conducted with the normal safeguards. We're talking about something else that's being pushed right now. Explain that to our listeners.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't understand the difference. Look, in 45 states, the District of Columbia, you can you vote in person normally, but you can also vote by absentee ballot. In some of those states, you need an excuse to do it. You know, you're sick, you're physically disabled, you won't be able to make it to a polling place on election day like our overseas military folks. In other states, you don't need an excuse. So a small, usually pretty small percentage of people take advantage of that. That's very different than five states, which unfortunately have switched over to all mail elections. It includes Oregon, Washington State, Hawaii also, in which they simply mail an absentee or mail-in ballot to every single registered voter. Now, the difference here is that in the other states where there's in-person voting, you actually have to request the absentee ballot.
Right.
You know, you normally have to fill out a form, provide them with your registration information, your name, your registered address, and you have to sign it and send it into election officials. That gives them some opportunity to try to authenticate it, for example, comparing your signature on the form to the signature they have on file for you to make sure you're real, you know, you're really the voter. That's very different from the five states that simply mail out ballots, because they're simply sending one to everybody they show as registered. And Tony, you and I both know voter registration rolls are in notoriously poor condition all over the country because states don't do a good job of keeping them accurate, of taking off people who've moved out of state, people who have died. And many of the voter rolls are just filled with names they should. Last year, Judicial Watch forced L.A. to settle a lawsuit they'd filed. L.A. agreed to take 1.5 million voters off its roll, people who shouldn't be on there because they no longer live in L.A. Think about what would happen if you had an all-mail election and 1.5 million ballots were mailed out to individuals who no longer live.
Yeah, and considering California's laws as well that allows ballot harvesting, I mean, you've got 1.5 million ballots floating out there that people can just collect, mark, and turn in. Do you think that could alter the outcome of an election?
Yeah, it certainly could, because the only thing that would prevent that from happening is if election officials catch that the signature on the ballot doesn't match the signature on file. But listen, when they're processing millions of ballots, clerks spend almost no time actually doing that. They just accept ballots, even in the states that actually try to do that. the average time I heard from an election official that they have to compare the two signatures is like 3 seconds.
Mm-hmm. But the rules that are being pushed or trying to be adopted actually do away with even the identification of the voter. So, I mean, we're talking about a, you know, wild, wild west scenario, basically, where anything goes in terms of these mail-in ballots. In your research, is there a particular, I mean, when your research covers all types of voter fraud, but is there a tool of choice when it comes to those who want to perpetrate fraud on our system?
Yeah, it's absentee ballots. And in fact, that's the largest number of cases in our database. And look, it's common sense to understand why. Those are the easiest ballots to steal, to alter, to forge, or to pressure voters with, because they're the only kind of ballots that aren't voted under the supervision of election officials, which is what you get in a polling place, and outside the watchful eye of poll observers. Mm-hmm. So all of that makes folks very vulnerable to this, and particularly vulnerable to pressure by political candidates or campaign staffers and others who show up at your door and push you to vote the way they want you to vote.
So, Hans, let's talk specifics, because some would say, well, you know, yeah, okay, so you're saying it's out there, but it's not real. I mean, you've documented, as I said, hundreds and hundreds of cases, but have elections been altered as a result of fraud? I mean, the outcome of those elections, has it, could you say, looking at the fact that there was so much fraud in a particular election, that the outcome could have clearly been altered?
Oh, sure. And I actually I got so tired of hearing that, well, even if fraud occurs, it never makes a difference. I actually just published a paper. It's available at the Heritage Foundation website on four elections that were overturned because of ballot fraud. It starts in the 1990s. It covers the 2000s. And the latest case was in 2018, just 2 years ago, in North Carolina. And that was actually a congressional right. election that was overturned because of fraud and other kind of illegal conduct involving absentee ballots. Heck, we just added a guy who was a mayor in Alabama who was removed from office last year after he was convicted of absentee ballot fraud in an election that he only won by 16 votes.
And there was just a recent case that's still unfolding in New Jersey where
right.
it appears to be pretty significant voter fraud.
Yeah, it's Paterson, New Jersey. They held a municipal election recently. They decided to have an all-male election because everybody's pushing them to do it. Four locals, including a city council member and a city council member elect, have already been criminally charged with fraud involving those absentee or mail-in ballots. And the evidence that's starting to surface includes everything from voters who were recorded as voting saying, well, I never got an absentee ballot, to evidence that one of the candidates may have used his campaign staffers to engage in wholesale forging of fraudulent ballots and sending them in.
So, Hans, we're out of time here, but very quickly, last question. Should Americans be concerned about the changing of the voting rules as we approach the election?
They should, and they should demand from local election officials that they have the opportunity to vote in person with the same kind of safety protocols in place that they see when they go to their grocery store or their pharmacy.
All right. Hans von Spakovsky, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure thing. Anytime.
And folks, to find out more about his work, go to TonyPerkins.com. Follow the links over. All right. When we come back, we're going to get a rundown on where the states are on changing their rules and how can they be modified to accommodate legitimate concerns. That's next here on Washington Watch. Don't go away.
Do Christians have a biblical obligation to participate in government? Do Christians have a duty to vote? And if so, what principles should inform them while casting their ballots? How should pastors think about politics, and how can they shepherd their congregations well during an election season? The gospel of Jesus Christ has implications for all areas of our life, including politics. Christians must be prepared to grapple with the moral issues of our day, the reality of our two-party system, and follow our Christian convictions to their logical end by voting for candidates that support clear biblical values. Family Research Council has partnered with 21 state family policy councils for a new edition of Biblical Principles for Political Engagement. This booklet provides biblical wisdom and clear answers to pivotal questions to help you navigate the political landscape. This publication exists to facilitate careful thinking about issues and encourage God-honoring political engagement that filters all issues and candidates through a biblical worldview. To read the full publication, visit frc.org/engage.
Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain, and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter or Parler, it's at T Perkins. And again, let me remind you, Values Voter Summit coming up September the 22nd through the 25th. It's online. It's virtual. You can be there. Find out how. Go to TonyPerkins.com. All right. As we were talking about at the top of the program with Hans, that, you know, we're not talking about making modifications within the current voting structure to accommodate the concerns of those that are in high-risk categories. Look, I get that, and I think we should make accommodations. That's not what's being pushed. What's being pushed is a radical transformation of our voting system with really no time to prepare, which will just lead to total chaos and confusion. And quite frankly, I think it will leave the results in such a manner that Americans won't accept it, which might be what the left's after. I don't know. So what accommodations can be made within the current election models that will not lead to chaos and confusion? What states have already altered their election laws, which were on the verge of doing so? And which ones now are most vulnerable to fraud? Joining me now to talk more about this, Jason Snead. He's the executive director of the Honest Elections Project. Jason, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, it's great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Well, appreciate the work you do. It's extremely important right now, given what some on the left are trying to do. But let's talk about it. There are some folks out there that are in high risk categories. They're fearful. Sometimes, I mean, I know that some of the fear is legitimate. I also think the media is fueling a lot of that fear, which is giving the left the ability to try to transform our voting system. But let's talk about what can be done under our current election systems to accommodate concern and those that might have health risk that don't want to go to the polls, but they could still vote.
Sure. Well, you know, I absolutely agree. I'll say at the outset that there are a lot of people who are in categories of you know, particular vulnerability to the coronavirus, who may contract it between now and the election and don't want to spread it to others. There are lots of reasons why I think folks are concerned about the more or less normal way that we would be voting, which would be just, you know, lining up in a line and going to vote in person. So what states have been doing over the past several months as they've been adapting their primaries and planning for November is developing a series of contingency plans, ways that they can adapt their elections and accommodate these sorts of concerns. And we've seen that there are some good models that have been developed and should be built on in November. And then there are some bad models that introduce a number of risks that are not really hypothetical. We're seeing them borne out in practice in a number of these states. And the models that tend to cause the most problems are the ones where states have rushed to transform their voting processes from a traditional, typical in-person voting experience to an all-vote-by-mail race. And, you know, we anticipated that anyone that tried to you know, do that on a dime, essentially, make that sort of a transition, would experience a number of problems trying to cope with the demand, trying to cope with the different processes for handling absentee ballots, that we would expect to see that there would be delays in getting ballots out, that there would be delays in processing ballots, that voters might get confused about how the new voting process works and be, you know, unable essentially to complete a ballot and make sure that it gets counted. And we've seen all of these sorts of problems in states like New York, in California, in Pennsylvania, parts of Georgia, where they've rushed into an all or mail first election and encountered these sorts of problems. There are other states that have decided that they're going to feature safe in-person voting. And I think that that is actually a better way to go, and offering voters the ability to do either in-person or request a mail-in vote.
Well, let me ask you about two of those items. First, I want to ask about the latter, that states have, you know, made minor adjustments to their systems to accommodate either expanding absentee ballot times and such like that. But you have documented that elections can be held pretty much as normal without risking a viral spike of the coronavirus based upon what we've already seen in some of these primaries.
Well, that's right. We've actually got now the benefit of hindsight. We've got experience with multiple states that have conducted elections, and we've got CDC guidance on how to do in-person voting safely. And so, you know, the election process for an in-person vote during a pandemic will, of course, look different than what we're accustomed to. There will be social distancing. Polling sites will, in many cases, have to be moved, either because they're typically situated in a nursing home or someplace where they would be exposing vulnerable folks to voters on a regular basis. We don't want that. Or they just need more space so that they can do the social distancing. And there'll be different processes in place the day of the election. You'll need to do regular routine cleanings of equipment, and you'll need to encourage masks and have poll workers wearing PPE. But all of this is feasible. And we've known as early in the pandemic as the April Wisconsin primary that if these sorts of precautions are taken, if there is planning done, and if states don't just wing it and decide that they're not going to have any precautions, that there is no reason that an in-person vote means that you're going to see a spike in COVID-19. In fact, the data suggests that this sort of precautionary steps can be taken and that you can vote safely in person. And so I think that helps to inform the best model for adapting our elections, which is to give voters choices in how they want to cast their ballot. A lot of the problems that we've seen in the vote-by-mail states arise from the fact that voters don't have any choices in how they want to vote, and the states don't have the experience running an all-mail election, and that's a dangerous combination.
Yeah, I would say, look, people are going to the grocery store every day, and they're doing just fine. So I would think that with the proper protocols, they could certainly vote without risk. Hey, let me go to very quickly before we run out of time. You made reference to, you know, these states that have moved very quickly to this all mail-in balloting. And one of the arguments is pointing to states that have all mail-in ballots. That music means we're up against a break. I'm going to ask you to hold on. Jason, can you stick with me onto the other side of the break? Because I want to ask you this question about the implications of rushing forward and how long it actually takes to get prepared for that. All right, can you stick with me?
Happy to.
All right. Jason Snead, Executive Director of Honest Elections Project, sticks around. I hope you will as well. It's important stuff, folks. You need to know about what's happening. And then we're going to be talking about what you can do to protect your ballot. That's coming up on Washington Watch. Don't go away. We're coming back right after this.
Oh, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed, so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I'd definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
Are you looking to grow closer in your relationship with Jesus and in your knowledge of God's Word? Family Research Council has released a new 3-part series titled 3 Ways to Read the Bible. In this series, Patrina Mosley, FRC's Director of Life, Culture, and Women's Advocacy, shares helpful ways to be encouraged and directed by God's truth through studying and applying the Bible's text. Now's the time to get to know God through His Word by looking into the Bible and learning what it says about God, humanity, and the power of Scripture. During this season of isolation, devote time to the Lord and seek out His meaning for you. In times of crisis and any time, this blog series is a great primer on opening your eyes and heart to Him through His Word. Check out this helpful resource and learn how to read the Bible with not just your eyes, but your heart. To learn more, visit frcblog.com. That's frcblog.com.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. So glad to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com, lots of resources there for you. In fact, folks, this is one of those programs that it's going to be archived at TonyPerkins.com, and you're going to want to send this around to your friends because you need to be equipped with, number one, the knowledge of what is happening, what the left is attempting to do with this election. You need to have the facts so you can push back. And we're going to be talking about in just a moment things, steps that you can take, very practical steps that you as a voter can take to make sure your vote counts. But I want to go back. Jason Snead is still with us. He's executive director of the Honest Elections Project. And Jason, one of the things you mentioned there in our previous segment, which I want to unpack a little bit for our listeners, is that often those who are pushing this mail-in all mail-in balloting. I mean, Nancy Pelosi pushed this. This was a part of their measure that they were trying to push in the corona response. They point to these 5 states that have already adopted all mail-in elections. But there's more to that story. Tell us about it.
Well, there's quite a lot more. In fact, there's years worth of additional facts to that story. There are 5 states before the coronavirus pandemic struck that had already developed the infrastructure for doing an entirely vote-by-mail election. And this is the sort of election where voters are mailed ballots, and instead of going to the polls, voters do they're balloting primarily through the mail. But that process, you know, that process of developing the protocols for voting, of training poll workers, of educating voters on the new methods that they're using to cast their ballots, takes years. And in fact, Washington State is a perfect example of this, because they spent roughly a decade gradually expanding the use of regular absentee voting. And then after they reached a certain threshold, spent 5 years of diligent, concerted work on the part of the state to make that formal permanent change to a vote by mail process. So that is a massive amount of work and a commitment to developing really an entirely new architecture and infrastructure for voting. And that's why the Washington Secretary of State, Kim Wyman, has been cautioning her colleagues in other states that if they do not have a lot of history, a lot of experience dealing with, you know, large volumes of mail ballots, that jumping to an all-mail election is not the solution for this year. That is not something that you can do at the last minute, that you can just throw together a jury rig, because you're going to run into lots of problems. And in places like New York and New Jersey and other states that have done that, we've seen exactly what she's cautioned against.
So part of the problems, obviously, not having the systems in place to ensure the integrity of the balloting by mail. But secondly, and probably one of the most significant, well, I shouldn't say that, because making sure there's integrity is quite significant, probably the most significant issue. But it's just the infrastructure and logistics of being able to process those ballots.
That's right. You know, you're talking about a completely different way of voting, and that applies both to you, the voter, and also to the people who are processing those ballots and administering the election. And so you've got to retool your entire process. It amounts to a top-to-bottom conversion of the voting process. It's not a Band-Aid sort of a fix or anything like that, and it's not the sort of thing that can be rushed into place, because we're talking about a very complex operation. And you know, any time that you're talking about something as complex as voting, if you are rushing in without advanced planning, without training, without the opportunity to test any of these systems to see, you know, what happens when they fail and what are the likely points of failure, then you're inviting chaos, because the first test of these systems at full capacity will be the November election. And as we've already seen, you know, they've been counting ballots in New York for nearly 5 weeks now since their primary, because they were totally unprepared, and that was a dysfunctional process. They were totally unprepared and overwhelmed for the number of mail ballots that they were having to process. New Jersey has been hit with voter fraud scandal when they abruptly changed their voting procedures to vote by mail. Again, just pointing out some of the unnecessary risks of this process. And, you know, one other thing that I'll mention here, whenever people who are advocating for this change point to these five states and say if they do it, anyone can, one thing that they never talk about is the fact that those states do not automatically mail ballots to inactive voter registrations. Those are the registrations the state believes represents people who have moved away, that they're no longer valid. And yet we continue to see in lawsuits and in proposals put forward in Congress the demand that states mail ballots to every voter registration, regardless of their active or inactive status, which guarantees that ballots are going to get sent out in the names of people who are ineligible to vote, people who have moved away, people who have died. That is not only wasteful, but that creates unnecessary opportunities for fraud.
Jason, 30 seconds left, but I, putting aside the fraud, a big issue to put aside, but putting that issue aside, just the inability to process the ballots, as you just talked about New York, 5 weeks later, still counting the ballots. If states rush into this and they're still counting ballots 5, 6, 7 weeks later in a nation that is already divided ideologically and politically, I mean, this could be absolutely explosive, because no one will accept the outcome.
It's going to be, I think, a very significant problem, because not only are you talking about a delay, you're probably going to be talking about a massive amount of incredibly difficult litigation. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be, I think, very similar to Bush v. Gore. And so that is an inflection point, and I think that's going to do damage to the health and the people's faith in our democracy.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Jason Snead, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate the work you do at the Honest Elections Project.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Folks, don't go away. When we come back, the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, joins us to talk about actions lawmakers and those who uphold the law need to be taking to protect the integrity of the system. Then we're going to talk about what you can do to protect your vote. That is coming up next. Don't go away.
The rapidly changing moral landscape of the 21st century presents a challenge for Christians committed to biblical sexual ethics. An uprising against morality has overturned centuries of norms concerning the family, marriage, and human sexuality. Secular culture is not the only challenger of Christian sexual ethics. Increasingly, theologically liberal churches and denominations are rejecting the church's historic teaching on marriage. As a result, Christians are facing increased pressure to compromise the Bible's teaching on human sexuality. How should Christians who are committed to God's Word respond to these challenges? What does the Bible teach about sexuality? Family Research Council has a new publication that presents the biblical principles for human sexuality. It lays out a survey of culture, scripture, and church history that will help pastors and all Christians meet modern-day challenges to biblical sexuality with truth and love. To access this publication, visit frc.org/sexuality. Again, that's frc.org/sexuality.
In today's culture, it can be difficult for men to navigate what it means to be a man and to find clear models of masculinity and manhood. There are many competing ideas out there and even confusion around the basic concepts of gender and sex. Where can boys, young men, husbands, and fathers find a model of manhood, leadership, and strength in today's culture of confusion? This is Tony Perkins inviting you to join me at a Stand Courageous Men's Conference led by men who are seasoned, compassionate leaders who understand the issues of the day. These issues will invest in unpacking our role as defenders, providers, instructors, and battle buddies so that men can have generational influence as a chaplain inside and outside the home. Join us at one of our upcoming events in Texas, Louisiana, Florida, or Virginia. Learn more about Stand Courageous and find an event near you at StandCourageous.com. That's StandCourageous.com. StandCourageous.com.
With horrifying acceleration in recent years, verified reports of murders, rapes, mutilations, and kidnapping of Christians in Nigeria have persistently increased. These attacks are frequently accompanied by the torching of homes, churches, villages, and agricultural fields. A July 15, 2020 headline reports that over 1,000 Nigerian Christians were killed in the first 6 months of 2020. This is in addition to 11,000 Christians who have been killed since June 2015. News stories about the assaults in Nigeria are rarely reported in mainstream media outlets. But when they are, they're regularly explained away as effects of climate change, local feuds, or religious wars for which both sides bear equal responsibility. For more information about the persecution of Christians in Nigeria, read FRC's publication, The Crisis of Christian Persecution in Nigeria, at frc.org/Nigeria.
This is Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad you are with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, as I talked about earlier, do we just need to resign ourselves to the fact that there will be election fraud and corruption that could alter the outcome of the 2020 election? Well, thankfully not. The law, at least for now and in most cases, protects the integrity of our election system. It just needs to be enforced and upheld. And Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is doing just that in the Lone Star State. Ken has been the attorney general for Texas since 2015. In his first 2 years, he sued the Obama administration 22 times, count them, 22 times, taking six cases to the Supreme Court. And overall, he has a solid win record against the federal government, better than 75%. He also previously served in both houses of the Texas legislature, including a seat that is now held by his wife. His office took over defending Texas's voting laws after they were challenged by several officials who wanted to ignore them because of, yes, you guessed it, the coronavirus. Joining us now to talk about what he did and why, the Attorney General for the state of Texas, Ken Paxton. Ken, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Tony. Appreciate it.
All right, first, just explain to our listeners what was at issue in Texas and what you did.
So we have a pretty simple law in Texas passed by the Texas legislature. It tries to balance this idea of the fact that we have much higher voter fraud in mail-in ballots. And I have proof of that just because we prosecute election fraud, and two-thirds of our cases over the last 10 years have been mail-in ballot cases. So the legislature has allowed people to vote by mail if they're disabled, physically disabled. They're going to be out of town
during the election. If they are in prison, but they're not a felon. And so I think the idea here is they want to provide legitimate voting for people, and they also let people who are over 65 do it. Legitimate reasons for voting by mail, but not open it up so much because, again, the risk is high. So we were sued twice, once in state court in Travis County, which is where Austin is. We lost there, of course. And then we also were sued in federal court in San Antonio. We lost there. Obviously, we didn't pick the venues. Others did. The Fifth Circuit took our case, put a stay on it, and right now we're waiting to argue the merits in the Fifth Circuit, but we've got it at least stopped for the time being. I think we've got a pretty good chance of winning. I'm almost certain we're going to win. And then the state case was a little more tricky because what they both judges had ordered was that mail-in ballots be sent out. Well, we were running out of time. And even though we thought we'd be successful on the merits when we got to the Texas Supreme Court, we were concerned that we wouldn't get there in time, be too late, and the election would be elections would be lost. So we had a court of appeals that was pretty liberal, and it seemed like things were going relatively slow. We weren't going to make it up. So we ended up using a procedure that we know has only been used like once. We found it in the election code where we mandamus the district clerks that were doing this in Travis County and Harris County and Dallas County, some of the bigger, more liberal counties, and we appealed directly, we mandamus directly to the Texas Supreme Court. We were successful 9-0 stopping the mail-in ballots from being sent out to everybody.
You, General, you made reference to at the start of this that your department enforces the laws that pertain to elections, and you investigate election fraud. And I've looked at the record, and there are quite a few cases in Texas that have to do with mail-in ballots that were used fraudulently. So this is not hypothetical. This is real. This is a real problem that would be, would become huge if every voter received a ballot in the mail.
Absolutely. And I get complaints from Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats typically don't want me to publicize the fact that they're calling me, but they do call me, worried about their own primaries and their own elections. And so it really is an issue for both sides. And when I was in the Texas House and we were trying to pass voter ID, the argument made by the Democrats was that we shouldn't focus on voter ID, which we ultimately passed. We should focus on mail-in ballots because that's where all the fraud is. They were the ones that said that, and now they're promoting it.
So what do you think if they're successful? And I'm not just talking about Texas. I'm talking about, of course, obviously Texas, a big state that, is demographically is trending in some ways that could lend itself to a state that could go blue. But that beside the point, when you just look at the process nationwide, would this be of concern to you? I mean, if we went to this all mail-in balloting where people are getting these ballots, don't you think that's going to undermine people's confidence in the outcome of the election?
If it doesn't, it should. As I said, the Democrats acknowledged it during on the floor. It's documented. But, you know, this is a strategy. This is a strategy going not just in Texas. This is a national strategy by the Democratic Party to push mail-in ballots. And if you can see the results in California, there's just no way a Republican can win statewide. And that's, you know, if you have unauthorized people voting and you can't prosecute it, you don't prosecute it, then you can't trust elections. And
right.
So we're going to have,
right.
If this continues, you know, I don't know how you win elections and know whether anything's credible anymore if you can't trust who's voting.
People lose confidence in the system, and that's the glue that keeps it all together is the fact that we have trust, although it's shaken from time to time. But a all mail-in balloting, given the prevalence of fraud that we've seen just in isolated cases, I don't see how you could have confidence in the system.
Well, in some of these states, they're not defending this. They're making a huge mistake because once it's in place, this is my concern. Once it's in place, it's like California.
Yeah.
How do you ever get it back? They just go out and figure out how many people they need to vote, and they get them.
I agree. That's the, you know, they're using the coronavirus. And we've talked about here on the program today how accommodations can be made within the current models, the systems, to, as you just pointed out at the beginning, those that are elderly. You know, we can expand the early voting or the absentee voting, but we don't need to send everybody who's on the rolls a ballot. That's just opening the election up to question, to compromise, to chaos. And quite frankly, I'm not sure, given what's happening right now in America, that we could sustain that.
Well, we can't. And what happens, what we've seen in Texas, is what the district clerks, when they're, you know, they notify their other party members, hey, we're mailing these ballots out this day and to this location. Go grab them and vote for them. That's how this is done. And it's not hard to do. They just notify their other Democrats that they're out there and they go harvest them. And that's our concern, that, you know, if that becomes the way it is, then we can't. There's no election that is trusted, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican.
All right. Attorney General Ken Paxton, I want to thank you for taking time to join us today, but also for being out there leading the way and defending the law and upholding the integrity of our voting system.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm glad you're covering this today, because it's important that this occur not just in my state, protecting integrity of elections, but in every state, because, you know, we're all in this together. And if other states are not trustworthy, it's going to affect all of us.
Absolutely. Without question. Attorney General, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
All right. Ken Paxton, Attorney General for the state of Texas. You can find out more. Go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. This is serious because it does undermine the confidence that Americans have in our system. And once we lose confidence in the system, what do you do? It's an important issue. You know, it's not just elected officials that need to protect the integrity of our election system. I mean, obviously, they have a role to play, but you and I have a part to play. And quite frankly, I think it's a big part. You know, you've heard me say before, as Americans, we have a right to vote. I served in our nation's military. I was in the Marine Corps. So many men and women who have served to protect the fundamental freedoms of this country. We have a right to vote. But as Christians, I believe we have a responsibility to vote. So that's a big part of voting. But there's ways to do it. And so what do we need to do? Joining me now to talk about this, Christian Adams. He's president and general counsel of the Public Interest Legal Foundation. Christian has also served in the voting section at the Department of Justice, where he won awards for outstanding service, and as general counsel to the South Carolina Secretary of State. He brought the first private party litigation resulting in the cleanup of corrupted voter rolls under the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, and he has handled cases in 20 different states. Christian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. I want to jump right into this one question of, you know, our role as voters. What can my listeners do? You know, we want to see lawmakers not change the laws and not, you know, use this pandemic to change the rules at the last minute. What can we do?
Well, probably there's two things. One is care and vote. And when you do decide to vote, the way to make sure that your vote is counted is to vote in person and to feed that ballot into the counting machine and make sure it gets counted. Because if you vote by mail, there's so many mail ballots every year that don't get accepted, that get lost by the post office, that are rejected for tiny defects. The way to make sure your vote counts is to vote in person.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, it's been documented. I think I've read this in your testimony before Congress, that since 2012, there's been somewhere in the neighborhood of 28 million ballots unaccounted for.
That's right. They were mailed out to voters who were going to cast absentee ballots. They never came back and were counted. A lot of those were rejected. A lot of them got lost in the mail. A lot of them went to the wrong place. I had one critic who criticized our characteristic as missing, as saying, they aren't missing, they're in landfills. It's like, well, Jimmy Hoffa is not missing, he's just unaccounted for. They weren't counted. There are 28 million ballots in the last four federal elections.
And so if you want to make sure that your ballot counts, the best thing to do is, if you want to stay away from the crowds, early vote, or, you know, turn that ballot in yourself. Don't let someone else take it for you, and make sure that chain of custody is maintained.
right, and get it into the counting machine. If you feel better having lots of hand sanitizer and a mask, even if you want to have goggles, wear them, because your vote is important, and voting by mail is not a guarantee that your vote will be counted.
Yeah, I'm you know, quite frankly, I don't want to offend our postal workers who are listening to the program out here, but you know, when you're getting Christmas cards on President's Day, it doesn't give me a lot of confidence in the Postal Service.
Like I said, we do not want to turn over who gets elected president of the United States to the organization that very often brings me my neighbor's mail.
Yeah. So the best thing to do in this election is every election is important, but I mean, this is going to be so close. Every vote counts. People need to vote. And so as Christian was saying, if you got to put on the goggles, the gloves, you know, I don't know, hazmat suit, whatever is required, go to the polls and vote. But there's more that we can do to protect the integrity of the system as voters, as citizens.
There is. I will tell you that there's a shortage every year of good people working as poll officials. You're essentially a government official running the election. And I will tell you that a lot of organizations focus on filling these roles up, these jobs up, with people who might be willing to, shall we say, bend the rules. And it's very, very important that people who care about clean elections volunteer to be poll officials. I guarantee, and plus a lot of times you get paid. I guarantee in your local hometown that they have a need for people to volunteer as poll officials.
Yeah.
I know it's not a lot of fun, but it's really important.
It is, especially, again, I go back to this election, how divided the nation is and what is at stake in this election. We need to be voting, and we need to be taking what steps we can to protect the integrity of our system. Christian, is it also beneficial for folks to, be talking about this topic on social media and maybe even in that antiquated model of writing letters to the editor, letting people know that, look, we can't allow our system to be hijacked by those that have ulterior motives, that yes, there might be concerns about the coronavirus, but there's ways to still vote and vote safely and ensure the integrity of the system.
Boy, you cannot understate how important that is. Everybody that I know has strong beliefs, but not everybody wants to share them. And I will tell you that, and I hate to draw lines of demarcation, but the folks who would let the vulnerabilities thrive in our system are very vocal, are very active on social media, are very much in your face evangelizing. It's their version of evangelization.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't doubt that. And they're out there evangelizing.
Christian Adams, thanks so much for joining us today, and appreciate all the work over there at the Public Interest Legal Foundation.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, you can find out more. Go to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links over. I've got links to Christian's work as well as the others you've heard today. And let me just underscore this. Talk about this. Talk about this. People go to the grocery store. They can go to the polls. Look, we need to show up. We need to be voting. Now, if you're in one of those high-risk categories, take the steps necessary to protect yourself. If you need to vote early, and that's one of the things we're encouraging states to expand the early voting to give people more time so the crowds are not as intense. But by all means, do not skip this election. And if at all possible, do not put your ballot in the mail. Hand it in personally. Vote in person if at all possible. Extremely, extremely critical. All right, folks, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Again, visit the website, TonyPerkins.com. Join us for the Values Voter Summit coming up September the 22nd through the 25th. More tools will be available for you there. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported.
portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.